This is Frank Collada, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Collada Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the studio of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, in the classic old ice house in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And our other... made famous in the movie Casino with Robert De Niro. But Joe Augusto, he was a pretty important source in this when you turned him. How did that come about? Were you talking to him one day and offer him a deal and how did that come about?
Well, Joe knew that he was going to be indicted. What got it started was when he was arrested on the charges out of Minneapolis on the check kite. He and Gustafson, the owner of the Tropicana, had been involved in a check kite, and Joe ended up in jail. And I guess basically, to put it, in simplest forms, couldn't hack it. He claims, and I'm not sure that this wouldn't be in his mentality at the time, about that time, Alan Dorfman, a major figure in this story, was murdered in Chicago. One of the theories was they were afraid that Alan Dorfman might talk. There was nothing to say he did. So Joe was saying, well, if they're going to kill people on the basis they may talk, where do I stand in all this? Because I'm in the middle of this. Now, whether that really affected him or not, he mentioned that it was part of his mental state at the time. But basically, he was in jail, couldn't take it, and knowing Joe, he was a manipulator, a deep thinker as to self-interest, and decided, I'll just go to the other side and save myself.
Well, did you get the call? How did he do that? I'm just curious, technically, how this happened. Did he sell his lawyer to get hold of an agent?
It's so long ago, I don't remember, but I think it came through the Strike Force.
Okay. Probably his lawyer went to Strike Force attorney.
Yeah, I think that they said, and Gene Tomachek and another agent went up to see him in jail. That's where it began. They brought him in, and he signed an agreement and started to cooperate.
So they debriefed him, and he supported a lot of these things. Then he testified in the Trop trial. Is that what you said?
Oh, yeah.
And then died before the Argent trial. The Stardust folks. The trial for the skim from the Stardust is called the Argent trial, and he died before that.
Right.
Now, you have a story about Joe and his relationship with the U.S. attorney, the assistant U.S. attorney up in Minneapolis. Now, we don't want you to get too fired up and start beating on that table. And folks, if you hear a lot of, that's Bill beating on the table, but that's kind of an interesting story about a kind of an interagency conflict. And I've been there. I had a deal myself between with the U.S. attorney and the FBI and the Jackson County prosecutor. And we had turned this gal who and made a case on her and filed the charge on her in Jackson County. And then she started helping Larry Tungate with the FBI, and she started helping him. And this is after the FBI got the mandate to start working some drugs. And she had facilitated a kilo operation with the grandson of Willie the Rat Camisano. She was helping to make that case, and she had some other guys that ended up working a case. We'll do a whole segment or a whole two shows on that called the Young Italian Investigation, which they took down Joe Pat Bolano and Willie Camisano's grandson, Tony Mike Nigro, and several other young guys who weren't really made guys, but they were kind of peripherally connected to the main guys, and would have eventually become made guys if they'd have been allowed to keep going continue down their criminal path. And I called the Jackson County prosecutor, and I said, you know, she's doing all this stuff for us. We need to drop those charges. And, you know, I told you when we started this, we were mainly using this charge to try to turn her. And now she's going to give some big stuff to us, and she's working with the FBI. And this prosecutor, she didn't say, she just stopped. And she said, well, she says, you didn't tell me that. She said, I don't agree with that. We're going to continue on with the case. I said, well, wait a minute. And she said, I told Brian Round, who was another prosecutor, I said, I remember telling him. She said, he denies you said that. I want to say, well, what did you turn and ask him? Was he on a speakerphone? What's the deal? And so I just hung up and told my boss, I think it was David Lynch at the time, who then went to the supervisor of the organized crime squad, who then went to the U.S. attorney, and then the U.S. attorney called over to the Jackson County prosecutor's office, and guess what? They dropped those charges. So you had a similar kind of a deal, only you didn't really have that, you know, bigger hammer to drop on your prosecutor, did you? What happened with Joe's check-kiting case up in Minnesota?
Well, as I say, Joe was in jail. They had been charged in a check kite, and now he's a government witness, having been debriefed and having committed himself entirely to the program. And it's time, and we're, of course, in touch with the United States Attorney office in Minneapolis. The Assistant United States Attorney, a guy named Doug Kelly, was handling the case, and we're talking to our counterparts in the FBI and indicating that this is one of the biggest organized crime cases in a long, long time, and this guy is a key witness. We need some help. We need some help in this case. I mean, it's a check kite. There's, you know, it isn't anything that he shouldn't get a break on for this cooperation. We're led to believe that they're in our corner and making moves in our behalf until we get to court in Minneapolis. We fly up with Augusto. He's been in our custody for a while for the debriefing. We got that handled, got him out of jail, and we were his jailers. And we fly up with him in court, and we're assured with winks and smiles that, everything is okay. And we go into court, and the judge slams him with a 20-year sentence. And the FBI guys are high-fiving, and the Doug Kelly is smiling, and the judge is congratulating himself. And the courtroom is like, they just got John Gotti convicted. So we're stunned. We've been backstabbed. My own counterpart there is patting us on the back. It'll be okay, and this and that. And so we're devastated because now what's going to happen to Augusto, we don't know.
And your main witness.
And main witness.
He's going to jail for 20 years.
Right. In
the federal system, he's doing 18 years of that.
Oh, yeah.
You were debriefing him down in Kansas City is the charge. You got him sprung from jail. You take him down there. You're probably spending a good amount of time with him. And obviously, when you fly back up for this court hearing, you're telling him, we got this handled.
Pretty much.
Don't worry about covered. This. This is not going to go bad.
Yeah. Well, you'll get some time, but you'll get some time, but we'll work out a deal where you're released on bond and this and that, and the whole nine yards. So we're backstabbed, and then what the judge does, And I guess he thought that this was going to be just a generous contribution to this investigation. So he says, in lieu of prison time right now, there'll be no bond for this man. Geez, you'd think it was a murder case. No bond for him. We're afraid he could, he's a foreigner in a way, has money in other countries, has a passport, he could flee. So what we're going to do in lieu of jail, you will be his custodians, the FBI. So you are his jailers. He's not free. You're to keep him in custody in any manner, shape, or form you decide. Now, this is an entire new operation that we have to go through. We now have to guard a guy 24/7. Harry Reid is not really in the picture. We've got so many problems going on. So anyway, a funny sidelight to the story. We get back to the hotel. Augusto, of course, is
he's devastated.
He's beside himself. And he says, you know what? And I wish I could do it in his broken, fractured language. He said, this reminds me of a fable. He said, there's a fable about this faraway, mysterious country of very little people. They're little, tiny people. And they go to the king, and the king says, to show the bravery of my subjects, I want you to go out, and I want you to bring me back a lion. And you little people will bring down this huge lion. And they go out and they scour the landscape and they find a squirrel and they kill this squirrel and bring him back and present him to the king as a lion. And he said, Doug Kelly,
the prosecutor,
just brought in a squirrel and made him out to be an organized crime lion.
I'm sure that's an old Sicilian tale.
I don't know, but Augusto could tell him. I'll tell you, he was, in a way, a delight to be around. It was a heck of a character.
Which made it understandable how he could gain the confidence of all those people out in Las Vegas.
But then to finish the story, Dave Helfrey, the Strike Force attorney, said, well, maybe we can still salvage this. I will have Doug Kelly come down to Kansas City and participate in obtaining the Tropicana indictment. He'll be there with me, interviewing witnesses, going to the grand jury. I told him, forget about it. This guy is a snake. He's not going to do that. Well, okay, give it a try. And no matter how many what progress we made, how much stuff Augusto came up with, how the case was going, Doug Kelly was never ready to say, I will now file a motion to get him out on bond, to take him out of your custody and your responsibility. He never could get to that point. He would never, ever see the light. And we had a big confrontation one night. I lost it, was screaming at him. And he packed up his bag. I don't remember what happened, but I think he packed up and left. And we were stuck with Augusto. And he unfortunately had a heart attack and died.
While in your custody?
While in our custody, yeah. The guys rushed him to the hospital, and he had a heart.
Where were you keeping him then at that point? All were you just like, here's an office in the downtown Kansas City in the federal building?
No. We moved him. Apartments here, motel here. I was constantly out finding places.
You even moved his beautiful young wife in with him, if I remember right.
Yeah.
That's one of the agents told me that, and you mentioned that today.
Yeah, he asked me, and it was something we normally wouldn't do, and all that. But, I figured, hey, I think we got a severely raw deal. And by God, I'm going
to... At least try to make up for it.
I'm going to let the wife come in and let them have some conjugal visits here.
Well, Joe Augusto, probably, you already had him incarcerated, hadn't you? Because of when you kind of brought the hammer down on everybody Wasn't he swept up as well?
Oh, yeah. He was charged and pled guilty before we even got out of the box. He was indicted
in
and
the
charged,
scam. For
in
the, scam.
In the Tropicana case. Yeah.
But then he got out.
He pled guilty and would have been sentenced, but he died before the sentencing.
But in between times, then he gets a sentence for this other crime of kiting checks up in Minneapolis.
He had the 20-year sentence hanging over.
20 years there.
And we were his jailer. We would have had to kept him in custody through the next trial, through the Arjun trial. And then if they never gave in Minneapolis, if they refused, he would have ended up in the penitentiary. We couldn't guard him the rest of his life.
Well, but I mean, he came forward. Wasn't he hoping to get a reduced or immunity?
Oh, well, no.
Other than the fact that he was hoping he wouldn't get killed.
No. He didn't get immunity. He knew he would be charged and would be sentenced. He would, of course, hope for a light sentence in the trap case for what he did, and he would hope that they would do something for him in Minneapolis. On a reduction of sentence motion or something after he had testified in two main trials, I would hope so. And I'm sure he hopes so.
Yeah, and they may have in the end.
And they may have. They
but
may.
You didn't know. They wouldn't give you any reassurance.
They up until the time he died, we were still in the mode that we're not going to bat for you.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was basically in an apartment or somewhere here in Kansas City at the time he had a heart attack.
We had
an officer or a federal agent there with him.
Oh, yeah. We had to have a crew here. We brought in agents from around the country who had to come in. I mean, it was an enormous problem and responsibility. So we had, we had to go shopping with him. He did a lot of the cooking, which guys were sorry to see him go. He was a hell of a cook. Oh my goodness, his Italian dishes but anyway, yeah, we were his jailers, and so we'd have to have minimum 2 or 3 guys.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
That's a scheduling nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, and
so you got 3 guys every day at least.
Yeah, yeah, and
a relief.
And of course, he was being debriefed constantly, so there were other agents over there. But the time and money it cost us was something we didn't need. We didn't need that on top of all the other responsibilities in preparing for this major trial.
Well, you had at least, $80,000 that you'd captured.
So, yeah.
To help kind of put towards the cause.
Yeah, that would take us about a month.
Yeah, and an interesting thing about that, Bill, people have asked me, well, whatever happened to all the money? And I always say, back then, now you've kept the $80,000, of course, but back then, the going after assets was not that big a deal.
No.
That didn't really happen, and they passed some extra laws after all the drug wars started, and governments realized that there's a lot of money just lying on the table, shall we say, that they could get. But back then, governments didn't really try to go after assets as much as
The $80,000 would have gone to the Treasury.
Yeah.
That's it.
There wasn't like a whole other financial investigative unit. Like even the police department has a financial investigative unit that their only job is to then go trying to trace assets. If you'd have had that then, a whole other squad to go and trace assets to try to show that.
Seize the Tropicana.
Seize the Tropicana, or seize the Stardust, or Joey Iupa's house and his cars and stuff like that, like they do today. They didn't do that back then.
No, it wasn't big back then. It wasn't. No, it the money just would go to the Treasury, and that was it.
And what little bit you got, we didn't really even try to get the extra money.
No.
Because there must have been a lot of extra money somewhere, because lived a pretty conservative life. That was part of the kind of the cover.
Yeah.
It was not to go, hey, we just received $80,000 or $40,000. Let's, go down to the Italian garden.
Yeah, really.
Well, everybody lunch.
I think that's been one of the unsolved mysteries that came out of all this, at least out of my career, and that is, what did they do with the money? Because they don't use CDs and traceable things. When we searched Nick Civella, they found a packet of diamonds. My theory is a lot of it was hidden, of course, somehow, And some probably went into commodities. Maybe they had gold stashed away somewhere, like Nick had diamonds, things like that. But how did they hide all that money? Very interesting. And I've never seen a cooperating witness. Maybe they've never been asked. But of all the people that somewhere, somebody might have said, you know, well, what did you do with your money?
Yeah, like Angelo Leonardo. He'd been getting money like that for quite
asked,
a while. They should have asked him. I don't know if it was ever asked.
Probably not.
Everything I read about him, there didn't seem like that came up.
That guy that was the courier, Caruso, I mean, they must have paid him at least a little something to do that.
Yeah, he got $1,000 a trip. Every time he brought back a packet, he got $1,000.
So he wasn't making any deal.
Oh, no, it wasn't any lucrative deal for him.
Of course, you know, and you found in the notes that Nick was cutting it up quite a little bit among about, 10 people?
Yeah, yeah.
Where he's getting a percentage of it.
Right. That's right. He was sharing with some of the top people in the mob here. He had a distribution. What's interesting, though, is they didn't know where the money was coming from.
Until
the case came out, because we got information that Felix Farina, one of the mob guys who later thought he was going to take over the mob and was killed.
Yeah.
Felix Farina was a little outraged by the fact, thinking that I probably didn't get enough.
he was in for like 5%, I think.
Whatever it was.
He was a lower level. He was under Willie, I think, and certainly under Ripe and Corky and the rest of them, and Tuffy.
But we got it back that when the case came out, they were, you know, like, oh, that's where some of this money was. I wonder how much more there was.
Yeah.
But Nick was sharing it, with some of his longtime members.
That Nick Civella, he was the mob boss excellence. I mean, he knew to kick a little extra Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew to make sure those guys that had supported him all those years were taken care of.
Yeah. He was the godfather.
He truly was. He was in the old school fashion.
And listening to him as you have done all those tapes. You get a real feel for what you know. One of my favorite tapes is when they had the long conversation at Quinn and Peoples' law firm where he was ensconced, thinking that he was safe in a law firm. We'd never be able to get electronic surveillance, which we did. But it was the conversation where Lefty once again was raising hell, had done the List extortion, was threatening to hold a press conference before his hearing, and they didn't know what he might say. That was what we discussed earlier.
They were petrified about what he might
say.
Yeah,
what's he going to say about Reed, you know? So now Nick is deciding, what are we going to do? Now, you would think these are thugs, you know. Hey, I'll get him on the line, tell him to screw off. He said, and Tuffy and him went into a long conversation. I'd like to reach out to Lefty myself. But is that within the protocol? Should I go to Chicago first?
Yeah.
You know, should we call up north? Will they be upset? And Tuffy's saying, well, you have a right to talk to him and all of it. And they went back and forth, and it was like at a board meeting. It wasn't like two thugs in organized crime deciding something about where they're going to eat or you know, in thuggish talk. Nick was like a CEO. Yeah.
Yeah, and even more so, I think the next day on their same conversation about the same subject, not the same but a different conversation about the same subject. They were talking about when he did talk to him, and Tuffy said, "Now don't start yelling at this guy."
Yeah.
And Nick says, "You know, I know I'm not going to yell at him. I'll treat him okay, and I'm just gonna ask him how you doing.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can do for you? I understand you have some trouble out there."
Yeah.
And then I don't have the tape, but I've got the transcript, and he does. He starts off with, "Well, how you doing? You know, Lefty, is everything going okay? Is there anything we can do for you out there?"
Like, oh yeah,
these guys were slick. They were they were not mafioso you think of at the old school. Just go out and break your legs and or you do what we say or we're going to kill you. They believed in the carrot as well as a little bit of stick. They apply the stick, but they use the carrot first.
Yeah, in fact, you may remember there was a conversation where this Carl Thomas talks about having contributed to the sheriff. And he said he got elected. And one of the things Nick said, you know, go easy with this guy now, you know, sort of break him in and all that. Don't make wild demands and all that. I mean, the guy was astute and in his own way, very impressive. I got to say that about him. He was a racketeer and he had people killed. But he did it in a very businesslike way.
Yes, he did. And that conversation, he also followed that up with, and he said, don't go around telling every shitting person you know that you got this guy. Don't, you just use him for the big stuff.
Right.
I mean, this guy was, that whole tape was a study in how to be a mob boss and handle a corrupt politician.
It
was amazing.
Lefty Rosenthal was Chicago's man.
Right.
So pecking order or protocol would have, Nick couldn't just directly call Lefty and, you know.
Well, they decided that he could.
He didn't talk to Chicago to say, hey, I'd like to call Lefty myself?
Well, he ended up not doing it, but it was a thought-out process. They considered what you just said. They discussed the pros and cons, the yes and the no, and Lefty, of course, knew Nick. Nick knows all those people in Vegas, and they all respect him. They knew his position in getting these loans. And the other thing that they knew is that he was well-respected by IUPA and the Chicago people. So in a way, they felt he had every right to call and chat with him, not chew him out, and which he didn't. He just asked him, are you considering everything you're doing? Are you sure you know what you're doing and all that? And they just decided that it would be proper for him to make the contact.
Of course, he reassured him that, I'm going to cool it. And Nick says, you know, just cool it, just cool it. And he said, I'm going to cool it. And then I think in a later conversation, DeLuna says, you know, did you ever think he might lie to you, Nick? But yeah, that's a good question, Aaron. And I think also another thing that supports that he didn't really need to call Chicago and get his permission is that obviously Kansas City had already been given the job to oversee all the skim operations in Las Vegas, because it was Tuffy DeLuna who went out and told Alan Glick he had to sell the Stardust, the Hacienda, the Fremont, and the Frontier, or the Argent Corporation. So already it was established that Kansas City, it was their job to kind of go out, boots on the ground, and be the front face to handle things in Las Vegas, Nevada, not Tony Spilotro like some of the movies might have you believe. It was Tuffy's job to go out and make sure that stuff was done.
Yeah, I think that showed Chicago's respect for Nick and all. And also, in a way, it was a little bit of a buffer, not their people that did it, but that wasn't the main thing. There were a lot of indications of how they viewed Nick. In one note that we found, when Kark and Tuffy were in Chicago to discuss something, they wanted to hold it off until Nick got out of jail. He was due out of jail. They wanted Nick there, and it was Nick who talked to Glick when they brought him up to Kansas City.
Right, right.
Not Ballesteri, not IUPA. I think they saw Nick as really the wheel pin of what was going on there, although Chicago retained the final say, and like they were the ones who got the main skim, and they were the ones who determined who the new owners of the Stardust would be once Glick was pushed out. So they still held the final straw, but they relied a lot on Nick Civella.
Interesting. Well, I don't know. Aaron, you got any questions?
Yeah, there was one more clip I had, soundbite here. It says 12.2, Augusto complaint.
It's kind of this is kind of really typical of DeLuna and Augusto as they talked about what's going on out in Las Vegas. And he starts off talking about, I don't mind this fucking guy to take his gun and commit suicide, but I don't want him to be a kamikaze. Augusto is talking about Lefty Rosenthal and this whole situation with threatening Clean Face or Harry Reid and having these press conferences, and they didn't know what he was going to say and how much he was going to spill.
You want me to play the clip?
Yeah, go ahead and play that clip. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, and then we'll close this down.
I don't mind this fucking guy to take his gun to commit a suicide, but I don't want him to be a kamikaze. We have been in solid business. He's a detective. I got my show, you know. I'm always on the marginal ground with those people, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want any shit to spill over, but to make it possible to live in this fucking town, you know. Starting out on the wrong foot now. Somebody, you know, and I think, you know, if it is not done, there's a lack of leadership someplace, you know, to tell this fucking guy, you know, where the stop sign is. I mean, if he committed the actions where he committed suicide, he should accept the fucking deal at all. Don't put another dozen of fucking people in the firing line necessarily by making a threat, opening it at those people. Because we are in a position, they think they gonna think like Clean Face. They think because they're afraid of this goddamn threat, so they do things which will put them more in fucking trouble they are now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. No, I mean, the thing is getting it too much out of hand. You know, of course, and let's just say if I was a stranger that I don't know this guy, friend, a connection, you know, I was here only to protect my own little mess. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I would take action myself. If I ask anybody permission, you follow me? If I didn't know better.
Mm-hmm. What are your fears, Joe? What the press conference?
I am in the fear of this motherfucker when he cannot take the fucking, he cannot take the consequence of his action. He already has made threats.
What kind?
He made a threat that he wants to make sure that he wants to tell that a Clean Face will call the channel, a channel call him, and he had an agreement, a deal, that he's going to stop the newspaper guy, and by stopping that, they were not supposed to bother him, and they were not supposed to disturb him. Instead, they pushed him around. It's all their fault. He wants to make a threat that he'd been giving $10,000 a month to somebody, you know. All the bullshit.
All he could be talking about is a $10,000 a month legal retainer fee.
Yeah.
The $200,000, is that a fact that Brown got $200,000?
Yeah, Brown acknowledged that he's received all at once, and as a matter of fact, about $300,000. I don't know which money this guy is spending. He should not be spending my money, but he didn't give that account that kind of money as a rebate on the taxes. But they make a big deal about it. You know, they think it's the bribe price to have Brown go to see list and make it a kind of proposal. But what I'm saying is,
what $200,000 are they talking about? What $200,000 or $300,000? Was it legitimate money that came from the corporation?
Yes.
Well, what's the harm there? I mean, where does Lefty think that he's got any kind of hammer there?
No, he don't.
Now, that's kind of a little insight into their relationship and what Joe was doing out there. That's kind of a conglomeration of things. But primarily, Bill, when he talks about this guy taking a gun and committing suicide and millions of dollars in business to protect, he's talking about the casino business out there and the skim that's coming out, isn't he,
out
of Las Vegas?
Well, this call was prompted by when Lefty was caught in the extortion attempt on List and then was going to be called in for licensing. And he made known, I'm going to have a press conference. And Augusto is discussing this with DeLuna, you know, saying where we're going to stop this guy because we don't know what he's going to say. And what he's saying, if he says certain things, like he says a kamikaze, we got all this millions of dollars to protect. He says, I got my show, that which is the Follies Bergère that Augusto ran to keep him as a person that could be in the trap. And he also says, I'm in marginal ground with these people, which means if Lefty would blow the whistle on Augusto, he's got the gaming people who already don't like him because they have suspicions about him. So he's worried about himself, his show, the millions of dollars that, and then, of course, the spillover into what is he going to do to people like Cleanface? He's concerned about all of that if Lefty blows his stack at a press conference.
Yeah, and there was another one that wasn't in this one. I was thinking it was where he said something about if Lefty keeps going, says none of the public officials will ever talk to us again if he keeps doing this.
Yeah, well,
he was embarrassing the public officials, the Gaming Commission and the Gaming Board. He was embarrassing them by continually bucking up against them. And he won't, as he says here, he won't accept the consequences of his own actions.
No. Yeah.
They want him just go ahead and go away into the night, and Lefty wouldn't do it.
No, that's right. He was not going to simply accept a licensing deal where he's not licensed or is thrown out of the casino completely. And then he goes on to remunerate some of the things that they were afraid of. And what they're referring to here is, it says, what kind of threat? He wants to tell the Cleanface called channel what that was about. And in fact, it eventually did come out, is that Jay Brown and Cleanface, Reed, get contacted by them and asked, you know, not to produce this letter, to put a kibosh on it and all of that. So that didn't put Reed in a good position. He shouldn't have been going outside of the commission and going to ask Rosenthal to do something to help in the gubernatorial race.
That was the allegation, not release the allegation that Bob List had actually gotten reimbursed per diem when actually he'd been comped by Left in the Stardust.
So he said, this guy is going to make an issue out of how they use Cleanface to do this. He said, yeah, no, that's not good, is what he's saying. This is going to tarnish all these people.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So, and of course, Augusto's wanting later on, he's wanting DeLuna to go to Chicago and, you know, put a stop sign on him.
And another thing I noticed in there said he was making threats that he had been giving $10,000 a month to somebody, you know, all that bullshit.
Yeah.
And I think he was indicating he was paying Channel $10,000 a month because right after that, he says, DeLuna says, well, after all, he could be talking about $10,000 a month, a legal retainer fee.
Yeah, there was that. And the $200 they're talking about is another cozy deal Rosenthal did by getting $200,000 of Stardust money sent to Bob Brown, the editor of the Las Vegas Journal or whatever it was, for prepaid advertising. It was another skim. They were taking money in that regard. So that money came up also, and so all of these factors had the mob very edgy about the Las Vegas scene.
On that $200,000, I talked to a guy out there, Mike Green. He's a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and kind of a mob historian. He was actually in the movie, and I asked him about this. He knew Bob Brown. He worked. And he was a young man. I think maybe he interned and he worked a little bit at that paper that Brown had. Brown had the, not the Review Journal, but it was a
I forget which. Sun? Las Vegas?
No, it wasn't the Sun. He started his own kind of upstart newspaper for a while. I think he'd worked for the Sun or the Review Journal for a while. And he said that Bob Brown had gotten some trouble financially, is trying to keep this little paper going. He got this prepaid advertising, but really what he was doing was helping with the skim. He was kicking some of that money back. Lefty was making it look like he was paying him a lot of money for advertising, and then he was kicking part of that back to Lefty, which was really part of the skim. And so it's just so many people involved with this stuff. It's amazing.
Well, there's another conversation. It was a conversation, I think. But anyway, it came about Carl Thomas when they brought him into the Stardust, when at that one period that Lefty was out before the Supreme Court reversed the commission decision, which was prior to Reed. But during that period, they brought Carl Thomas in, and he said the Stardust was leaking like a bucket with 1,000 holes. And he went through all of the things that they were doing, and one of them was this prepaid advertising. So what you just said was just as a form, another form of stealing from a hotel.
Well, it was amazing.
Well, in all of this, I mean, Rosenthal was Chicago's man. So if they were so concerned about it, why wouldn't Chicago replace him? Because that would seem to be the most appropriate thing to do.
Well, that's a good question. And what had happened in one particular conversation, and we had, I think, some notes, too. Lefty was called to Chicago, and I remember Augusto said when he went up there, he was out. Or DeLuna did. When he went up there, he was out. When he came back, he talked his way in. So what he did to convince him, we don't know. But at one point, they were prepared to deep six him. He talked his way back in. But Lefty was like Augusto. He was a force to be reckoned with. But that's a good question, why they weren't more forceful. They should have been on the line to him and tell him, you know, knock all this stuff off. Of course, they tried to kill him later, so maybe that was the answer.
Yeah. They may not have had anybody else lined up to move in and take that over particularly.
Well,
they would have had to handed over to Kansas City. Yeah. And let Nick Civella really be in the catbird seat and have his own guy in there, cause, which he could have done with Carl Thomas, but Carl Thomas was Kansas City's guy, too.
Yeah, we're talking about two different things. It wasn't an ownership issue at this time, so they needed to find another competent skimmer to be the casino guy. So they could have found another casino guy.
But they were also talking about selling.
That was later.
Who was going to be the new owner of the Stardust? Lefty was getting in the way of that.
Yeah,
they knew that was coming down the pike.
Yeah, he had some input in that too. Yeah, but they could have fought off the ownership and not given it to anybody, which they didn't, and replaced Rosenthal. But all of it was something they didn't need. They didn't need all this high profile stuff. They had been doing very nicely prior to this.
Yeah, well, but 1983 or so, it became a moot point, didn't
yeah,
it, Bill?
Yeah.
They all went to jail for the rest of their lives, yeah. Basically.
And
Lefty Rosenthal went into hiding, Joe Augusto died, and Carl Thomas,
he went to jail.
He went to jail for a period
for a while,
of time.
And then he went to the West Coast and was killed in an accident
car
of
accident,
some sort.
Yeah.
But, I truly believe all our effort, all of the law enforcement effort in this, that was the final straw for Vegas.
Yeah,
For the mob, whatever was left was going to be shortly gone, and it's all corporate.
And it's pretty much the final straw for the Kansas City family.
Oh, yes.
It appears to me Kansas City family is just like nothing.
Yeah, anymore. They couldn't recover.
They're hardly even a subset of Chicago. They still got some of their younger relatives doing some few things, but not anything that you could really tell. A
couple million dollars in illegal gambling, but
what?
They got caught for that.
Oh, they did have a
look
book.
Look on Wikipedia. They did have a talk
book.
About.
They did have a book going for a while, but didn't last
that
very
internet
long.
Thing, the
that
internet book. Yeah, thing, I don't know. What, yeah.
But it's just not like what they used to do. I mean, that was one little operation. They used to have so much going. You can't go out and you can't go buy a stolen record anymore. Tiger's gone. You can't go buy stolen perfume and everything else you might get out of a drugstore because Junior Bradley's gone. Jerry Stevens is gone. They dealt all the stolen clothes. I mean, it's just, you know, it's really been in disarray.
Yeah. Junior Bradley's gone.
Yeah.
Well, the labor union.
The labor union lost all the power.
Politics gone.
Right.
The mainstays that made them what they were all disappeared after Strawman.
Even the book, I mean, you can go to the casinos and gamble now.
Yeah.
So there's still a book, but they don't. It's not like
well, they
lo- the
yeah,
was.
without all the other power that they had, their monopoly on things like bookmaking or fencing or whatever they wanted to monopolize, they didn't have it anymore.
Yeah.
They they didn't have, it was just a death knell when you lose all of your main people.
I've got some contacts up in Milwaukee, and it appears to me there's a little bit of something going on there, but not much.
I would guess
hardly
not.
Anything.
I don't think.
I don't even think they have a boss anymore. What they call a boss anymore.
Probably outside of Chicago and New York, there are even Detroit and Cleveland. Pittsburgh, all the main cities have been devastated, and it just got to the point where they were losing people. People were turning coat. There wasn't any reason to be part of this anymore.
Yeah. All right. I think we've done this. It's a pretty long section.
Just kind of kept going there. You're going to have to cut that in half.
You'll have to do some editing on this, baby.
If I can cut that in half or not, I'll try to. Sometimes it's hard to do. All right.
Let's thank Bill Owsley.
Let's thank Bill, and let's mention his books again.
Mobsters in Our Midst. And his other one, From the Origins of the Kansas City Mob to the 1950s, Open City.
Right.
Both of which are available on Amazon.
Amazon and eBooks, Amazon, either one. Right.
Do you still have any copies that you sell yourself?
I got copies. I haven't been selling many. I don't get out much anymore.
I need to buy a couple of copies from you. I got a place for them. So I forgot to call you back today and tell you to bring them over. I'll get them from you.
Okay. Yeah. And... do you have a copy, Aaron?
No, I do not.
Well, when Gary picks one up, I'll give you a signed copy.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
Both of them, if you want them.
Maybe this time we can get a photo with you, with the three of us.
No, okay, yeah, we'll take a photo of the three of us this time, but with a little better light than the last time. That last time, we did a photo, you and I, and he took it, and it was in crappy light. I put it up on the website. It's like, oh, my God.
Who are these?
So we figured out how to turn the lights where we could take a decent photo.
Yeah. Are we off here now?
Not yet. You know, let's go ahead and finish this off, and I'll say one more thing. People out there, you know, Bill and I and Larry Wisher and Harold Nichols and Bobby Arnold and Tomachek and I can't remember who some of the other agents back then. We had a good time. God, we did all those surveillances. I can't remember a lot of their names. They're all gone. A lot of them were this. Tony Triplett, he's still around.
Yeah. Some of them come and gone.
This was their first office. So guys on their surveillance I worked with, I can't even remember their names now, but we had a lot of fun in those years. I mean, I know it was a lot of work. It was a lot more work for you than fun, maybe. But
well, no. Turned out to be...
It was a good time, you know, and we really felt like we did something. And I think we did. We irrevocably changed... history,
absolutely,
for a better, safer world. I mean, everybody I hear people talk about, I laugh. Las Vegas was much safer back then. Well, you know, you don't even know what you're talking about safer. You know, the mob, they're gonna take care of all these crack addicted street kids. I don't think so.
Yeah,
they're gonna run from them themselves. So it's just a different world today.
Sure.
All right, let's do my public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative that's got a problem with drugs or alcohol or any addictive behavior, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
Remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personal guided tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And remember to buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon. And if you make a $25 or more donation at ganglandwire.com, Gary will send you an autographed copy of his DVD, Gangland Wire, as long as you live in the United States.
And go to my website and subscribe, and I'll send you a link to a free 2017 mob events calendar that I created and put up. I may have some hard copies made one of these days, but right now, just for subscribing to my website, you'll get a PDF of that calendar.
And Gary's got a book.
Well, I'm working on it.
It might be out by the time this comes out.
It might be out one of these days. It's getting close. It's going to be a lot about the story we just told tonight, and in a little more detail and a lot more. In the electronic version, you'll be able to, of the book, the Kindle version, you'll be able to hear probably 25 or 30 snippets from wiretaps, maybe even more. I can't remember exactly how many I put up, but basically I put in the wiretap transcripts and link to the wiretap audios and explain each one of those wiretaps as you listen to it.
From the mouth of the men that did it.
Correct.
Ganglandwire.com.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Bill.
Goodnight, and it was a pleasure as always.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.